Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to address this particular topic, and it's a, an honor to be invited by Richard. I must say, though, I was starting to panic about this talk last Friday, and then I asked Richard, well, should we use metric units or shall we go with the English units in terms of yields and nutrient use and so on? And he recommended to me to do metric. The trouble was I was doing my presentation late last night, and I converted some of the slides, but not all of the slides. So I'm afraid that in today's presentation, I'm not going to satisfy either the Europeans or the North Americans. There will be a bit of both, and I apologize for that in advance. Might also say that the question that's essentially before us in this presentation is, does ethanol really change the nutrient dynamics of corn production? Dr. Kim Palazzotto kind of alluded to that in terms of what it might mean. And I'm basically going to divide this question into kind of four different what-if scenarios. I think the impacts on the first one, which is basically crop rotation, where's my mouse? Here we go. Crop rotation and tillage changes adopted to increase the corn production. So basically, okay, how much is the rotation going to change? And at the same time, I think it's important in nutrient management also to consider the tillage change. The other one, of course, is going to be the changes in the ratios of grain prices to nutrient costs. And those very high nutrient costs that we just heard to are going to change the equations on some of the calculators that we use to determine optimum nutrient rates. Then is it grain only, or is it grain plus or minus manure? And if manure is in the situation, then that's certainly a factor. How about grain plus a fraction of the stover? Perhaps it's cobs that are going to be harvested in cellulosic ethanol production, first of all, maybe later on the stalks. And then again, is that with or without manure? And finally, if it's manure, whether that manure is actually coming from livestock with a dry distillers grain intensive diet, which might be, let's say, as high as 20% in pork or as high as 60% perhaps in beef cattle, and John Laurie will get into that aspect of it, and I won't cover that part of it today. Corn yields, of course, if we look at things from the mid-1960s until this past 2006, have been increasing over this past 43-year period at a rate of about 1.8 bushels per acre per year. And Ken Kassman last year kind of outlined sort of some of these major factors in terms of why that might be. And management is a key part of it. It's not just the genetic increases that have happened. And if as we look forward to what the implications of ethanol are, a large part of it is going to be whether or not we believe the claims of those in the seed industry that we will change from this 1.8 bushel per acre per year rate of increase that we've had for the last 40 some years into perhaps something that is 3% per year. And that affects a lot of things. It affects the rotation practices, it affects the nutrient management that we do. Might say when we talk about corn on corn, there's a couple of different options here. And just to think about it from a farmer's point of view, first of all, let's say you're a 2,000-acre farmer. And in 2006, you're comfortably going along 1,000 acres of corn, 1,000 acres of soybeans. In 2007, now you've decided to switch to 75% corn. Well, that means that in 2007, you still had 1,000 acres of first-year corn. But notice what happens in 2008. Now you're down to just 500 acres of first-year corn and 1,000 acres of 7-year corn, and you notice that from here on in, you're only going to have 1/3 of your corn that is essentially first-year corn. You're always going to have 1/3 of your corn as well that is third-year corn. And I think when we think of nutrient implications, a lot matters whether we have that kind of a scenario with essentially a lot of third-year corn, or whether we have, let's say, a farmer that switches only to a 2/3 corn rotation system for their crop or for their fields. Because in that case, if it's only 2/3, then essentially we always have equal numbers of acres of first and second year corn, and providing the rotation holds for the fields that farmer farms, there will not be a situation of having third year corn. And I'm going to come back to that a little bit later, because I think that the nutrient dynamics, particularly for nitrogen, are somewhat different if we have third year or continuous corn. Fertilizer management issues for corn after corn. One of those is the fact that starter is much more important. And this is a function in part because of the increased residues, the immobilization that occurs. It's particularly true with early planting dates. And this is just an example of a skip at one of our nitrogen trials in 2007. The starter was omitted on this particular row here. And you can kind of see that it looks yellowish and probably will yield less in this corn after corn situation. So the bigger question, though, is whether we need more nitrogen for corn after corn, and how much more nitrogen. And across the Corn Belt, that is the subject of debate, you might say, as well as fairly intensive measurements that have occurred. To put this into context, though, it's also fair to say that overall, the nitrogen use efficiency in corn has increased dramatically since 1980. And if we look at this red line here, it's bouncing around somewhat, but essentially nutrient use efficiency interpreted as the kilograms of grain derived per kilogram of nitrogen applied have certainly been increasing. And the total fertilizer rate that's applied per acre, per hectare, has remained relatively flat until 2005. And that is going to change. So part of our question is will this gradual improvement that we've seen in nutrient use efficiency change when we go to more corn-dominant rotations than we've had so far? How much more nitrogen is required for corn after corn? One of the studies being conducted by my colleagues, Bob Nielsen, Jim Camberato at Purdue University over this past year, looked at five locations of continuous corn and corn-soybean. And they calculated, after doing these trials, the nitrogen rate to get a yield maximum for that particular rotation, for that particular average for five environments, and it works out to something like 34 more pounds of nitrogen to reach Y max. If, however, you look at things in terms of an economically optimum nitrogen rate, then the difference was about 28 bushels. So it's very, very close to 30. But although you're applying about 30 more pounds of nitrogen, you notice here on the right-hand side that the yield is still about 18 bushels per acre less for corn that's producing about 180 bushels. So it's still a 10% yield reduction and about something in the neighborhood of 30 to perhaps 40 more pounds of nitrogen per acre. Now, coming back to this question as to whether continuous corn and its nitrogen requirement is any different than second-year corn, I want to pick up on some data that Joe Lauer kindly lent me for this particular slide. So first of all, on the extreme right, we've got continuous corn, low nitrogen versus recommended nitrogen. Low nitrogen here means something around 80 to 100 pounds per acre. Recommended nitrogen is between 160 and 200, varied somewhat from one year to the next. So you can see here, continuous corn yielding fairly poorly at only 133 bushels with the recommended nitrogen. First year corn, after 5 years of soybeans, now we're up to 160 bushels. The recommended nitrogen. With the low rate nitrogen, there's a yield differential here of 11 bushels less. So now we're at 149. Now we go into the second year, and you see that the difference between the recommended N rate and the low nitrogen rate applied at equal rates for all of this second year corn, third year corn, fourth year corn, fifth year corn, you kind of see that the gap grows, the yield gap between the recommended and the low rate. And so the argument that Joe Lauer makes with this particular study is that in essence, the nitrogen requirement for third year corn may in fact be somewhat higher than it is for second year corn. And that's why the choice in part of the rotation system makes such a big difference. Now, I have the good fortune of interacting with another three authors in the study, and you'll see some references to their comments and contributions as we go through. One of those is the Nebraska Ecological Intensification Study, which has been a project that Ken Kassman, Dan Walters, Akeem Doberman have been looking at for the last 7 years or so. And they're essentially comparing continuous corn and the corn-soybean rotation with two management systems. The one is a recommended for the average Nebraska situation in irrigated production now, versus intensive, and intensive means growing corn at higher plant populations, perhaps close to 40,000 plants per acre, higher nitrogen, perhaps going up to something in the neighborhood of 300 pounds per acre. And then there's the corn soybean, and again, recommended for the corn soybean rotation versus intensive, high plant population, higher rate of nitrogen. The difference in the nitrogen rate between intensive and recommended is about 60 pounds per acre. And when you look at the overall implications for global warming potential, where global warming potential is calculated as agricultural production carbon plus the delta change in soil organic carbon plus soil N2O plus soil N2O emissions, that is, to the atmosphere plus soil methane changes, and you kind of see that it's possible that continuous corn producing at 238 bushels in this intensively managed situation will result in less global warming potential than is the case with intensive corn in the corn-soybean rotation. And you can see that in terms of global warming potential, the lowest global warming potential actually occurred with the recommended nitrogen rate for continuous corn in this irrigated system. And the big reason is why there seems to be a bit of a gain in the overall global warming potential with continuous corn compared to rotation corn is all because of the capture of additional carbon with that continuous corn system. And you note here in the intensively managed system, there is even more capture of carbon in the soil. So these are high yield systems, all 220 to 250 over that 6 year period. So a big thing that's going on then, of course, is the fact that, and these are switched, now the continuous corn is on the right, corn-soybean rotation is on the left, but essentially what's changing in the continuous corn system is if you look at the annual carbon return, you might say, in the residue, that and the average, nitrogen return in the residue, you see that it's highest in the continuous corn system with the intensively managed system because of higher populations and higher N rates. And then that has a consequence then for the delta change, you might say, in soil organic matter carbon in the blue and total soil nitrogen in the yellow, in that in the continuous corn systems with this irrigated production, intensively managed, it's actually possible to get a gain in overall carbon. Now, Dan Walters, as part of this Nebraska study, is also looking at things at a field scale rather than just a replicated plot, which are fairly small. And so they're doing things with carbon dioxide fluxes using eddy covariance, they are looking at things that are much larger blocks, be something in the neighborhood of perhaps 40 acres for some of these various plots, you might say, on pivot irrigated land. First of all, no-till irrigated continuous maize, producing 12 to 13 tons of grain, residue carbon returned as high as about 4.8 tons per hectare. Then you go to no-till irrigated maize soybean, and now you see that the residue carbon that's lower because of the lower carbon being returned in the soybean year. We still got over 4.5 or something like that for the corn year. We only have approximately two tons of carbon contributed in the soybean year. So now we're at a minus 24% deficit in total residue return. And then if we go to a rain-fed system in that same environment instead of the irrigated system, and again looking at the rotation system, then we're getting less carbon returned in the corn residue and less carbon returned in the soybean residue because of lower overall yields. Now, instead of producing 13 tons, we're down to 8 tons of corn and around 3 tons of soybeans. So that all has implications for looking at the net ethanol emission offset that would occur with these production systems. And in irrigated continuous maize, if you look at those high yield levels at about 13 to 14 tons per hectare, which would be the same thing as perhaps 230 bushels per acre or something like that, we essentially have a lot more basically ethanol yield, you might say. And even though we have higher costs of equivalent carbon because of the higher input costs associated with more nitrogen fertilizer, we still end up with a offset that is much bigger. And so you could argue, depending on your environment, that sometimes continuous corn isn't necessarily detrimental from a global warming point of view. And Dan Walters has more studies on this, and he's going to be presenting at the Crop Rotation Symposium that's scheduled tomorrow, and he'll be speaking at 1, and really encourage you to consider attending his talk tomorrow afternoon at 1. Switching from nitrogen, more phosphorus is removed by corn. Kim also alluded to that. And in these calculations, I'm just going to use the standard tri-state. Tri-state means essentially Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan. It's basically a fertilizer recommendations. And in these tri-state recommendations, we say that we're removing about 0.37 pounds of P2O5 per bushel. And that's much less than is the removal for soybeans. And so these are some of the comparisons where you can kind of see at different yield levels we're removing more phosphorus if we're harvesting just the grain. These are the literature values provided by Scott and put into a figure form by another co-author, Dr. Paul Fixon. And you can essentially say that the figure that's used in the tri-state for phosphorus removal is about 0.37, and that occurs right around here. You also see a lot of variability in phosphorus in the grain. More recently, in Indiana, as a result of some funding from PPI, now called IPNI, I'm sorry, we essentially have looked at phosphorus removal in the grain at somewhat higher yield levels, perhaps, than those earlier studies. And the green line here is the constant line if you assume the tri-state recommendations of 0.37 pound of P2O5 per bushel. The red line shows where we're at currently in the last 6 years of analysis of the grain phosphorus removal at yield levels going from 150 up to about 280. And so that's this slide, although the R-squared is only 0.21, it's significant but low. So essentially there's a lot of scatter here, different hybrids, but these are in intended high-yield environments for our rain-fed agriculture in Indiana on growing on a molosol. And essentially what this would argue is that there's, if anything, perhaps a somewhat low removal estimate at that 0.37. At least for this particular environment, and there's over 550 samples in this cloud of data. Another one is, of course, the fact that there's less K removed by grain corn, and fortunately, the recommendation here by the tri-state is 0.27 pounds of K2O, and Dr. Brudere at Purdue University as well has basically concluded that based on her recent analyses of from potassium tests that have been running for many years, that this figure is perhaps fairly accurate. Now, when we think of corn, we're not just thinking of grain corn for ethanol. We're also very concerned about stover removal. Dr. Stuart Burrell, or Burrell perhaps, from Iowa State University lent me these slides. And they represent some really interesting engineering kind of work to look at the opportunity to harvest stover as well as grain in a single pass. So essentially you would take part of the stover material and you would essentially feed it through along with the ears into the combine. And there would be an additional chopper on the back rather than just chopping, you know, the cob material that comes off of the grain tables. Now you're essentially chopping stover or the stalk and leaf material that comes through as well as the cobs. And so then this is blown into a forage wagon that only an Iowa State engineer could design. So essentially, he needs some help from Purdue University is what I'm recommending. So essentially, the comment here is, you know, what are the opportunities here in terms of how feasible is this and on the nutrient status of soil? One of the best papers, Dr. Graham's paper in the Agronomy Journal early this year, in January, I believe it was, came up with a removal possibility. And the removal possibilities on stover came with the assumption that corn stover removal should never exceed 70% of what's actually out there in the field because there are mechanical constraints to how much can be removed and should not ever exceed soil T or the tolerance level. The calculation here is that basically if there is no change in tillage practices, we could remove something like 64 million dry tons. If it were all mulch-till corn being produced and the acreages were the same as during that test period, then we could collect 76 million. And if we're all no-till, then we could remove almost twice as much. But recognize that this occurs with these assumptions and does not consider the costs of nutrient removal along with the stover. Now, I might say that a lot of these studies that estimate, whether it's a DOE study, whether it's Graham study, whatever, are estimating total stover yield. In many cases, they are using a harvest index assumption of 50%. Is it really 50%? And is it still 50% when you go to progressively higher plant populations or when you push nitrogen rates higher? And over the last few years, a graduate student of mine has been looking kind of at how much weight is in the grain, how much weight is in the stover, and how much weight is in the cob for corn grown at a density of 54,000 plants per hectare, which is essentially 22,000 plants per acre, 79,000 plants per hectare, which is essentially the same thing as 30,000 plants per acre, and then 104, which would be around just over 42,000 plants per acre in the final two here. And my comment here is that when you go, this is on a per plant basis now, when you go to progressively higher nitrogen rates, and this is 170 to 340, it's in excess, I'll accept that, but part of the way to get more stover is in fact to have more nitrogen added. Even when the nitrogen doesn't cause very much of an increase in the grain that's actually harvested. So nitrogen and plant density have an impact, then you might say, on the cumulative stover yields. And in these studies, the harvest index was averaging about 53 to 56%, meaning that the stover yield is really only around 45%. The fraction that has about the most consistency in terms of stover weight on a per hectare basis is really the cob section. Whether it was a low plant population, an intermediate plant population, or a very high plant population, regardless of whether the nitrogen rate was 340 kilograms per hectare or 170 kilograms per hectare, the cob weight was about 1.2 tons per hectare. And again, that cob weight is somewhat lower than what we see in estimates in the literature, where it might be as much as 6% of the total above ground weight, including the weight of the grain plus the stalk and leaves and tassel and so forth. So I guess why I'm pointing out the cob material is that I think there's an opportunity to, in a cellulosic environment, to remove the cob and to perhaps try to leave the rest of the stover in the field. And there are some designs that, 5 minutes, thank you. So nutrient concentration variation in corn at harvest, I'm just going to point to the bottom of this one, which is basically, this is a very large data source from Achim Dobermann and colleagues, which essentially show that the mean nitrogen in the stover, based on 2,500 corn samples collected over since 2000, is absolutely meaningless when it comes to determining nutrient budgets. Because look at the phosphorus content in stover. It's the mean is 0.05%. The range is 0.01 to 0.42. The potassium in the stover, 2.18% is the mean. The minimum 0.15, the maximum 4.17. And I might also say that potassium in the stover is also going to be affected by how soon after grain harvest or after physiological maturity is that stover actually going to be harvested. The later it is, the worse it is. I might also say that in terms of molasol environments, there are some really interesting studies going on currently in the Corn Belt. One of those is by Jeff Coulter, a PhD student with Emerson Nafziger at the University of Illinois. And they're essentially looking at the question of tillage options for corn after corn. And this is being conducted 2 years, two locations, and so it's relatively early stages of the study. But I'm very encouraged about it. As a no-till and strip-till corn promoter, and I use that loosely, I'm a scientist first, promoter second, but I like to see data that essentially supports the use of no-till. And no-till has always been a challenge for us in a corn-following corn system, and especially in continuous corn, where you have not only two-year-old corn residue, but perhaps three- or four-year-old corn residue. Well, this study looks at all of the residue removed, and you see how close the no-till yields are to the chisel plow situation. On the other hand, if you remove half, the gap between the two tillage systems increases, and the worst no-till producing perhaps something in the neighborhood of 15% less in this molasol environment than the chisel plow is in a situation where we're growing essentially 200-plus bushel corn and where we're leaving all of the residue. So in part, this whole dynamic of stover depends a lot on what is the assumption in terms of how much residue is removed, and then that's followed by what is the tillage system actually going to be. And it's also affected, of course, by the optimum nitrogen rate. The optimum nitrogen rate where all of the residue is removed is actually a lower optimum nitrogen rate than is the case for a situation where none of the residue is removed. And none of the residue removed automatically means probably a higher effective optimum N rate. The final study that I'll look briefly at is one by Harold Van Ess and at Cornell University, and they're essentially looking at 32 years of no-till, residue returned, residue harvested, as well as moldboard plow tillage for 32 years in northern New York State. So this is residue removed, kept, no-till versus plow. And they looked at a lot of parameters, but I just wanted to point out a few. They effectively analyzed soil quality, as Dr. Van Ess's program does so well. Aggregate stability, residue harvested versus non-harvested, doesn't really makes a small difference, but the bigger difference is between the tillage systems. Higher aggregate stability in no-till versus plow. Higher available water when the residue is returned in no-till than is the case with the other systems. Bulk density lower. These are all good things from a no-till point of view. But when you look at potassium in this particular study, the potassium values are alarming. They're alarming in the sense that the potassium values are much lower where all of the residue has been harvested, whether it's no-till or whether it's in the conventional plow tillage system. And what these are very, very low potassium values, I might point out. And so what that means is essentially what we would expect. If you remove all of the residue, and if you're not applying enough potassium to compensate or no manure, then essentially you can expect results like this, where basically you've got no-till residue return and even plow residue return. No-till looks decent. The plow tillage with the same residue treatment looks very potassium deficient. So meeting the challenge, in the words of Paul Fixon, will require our best science and our growers' best agronomic management, and I agree with that, but I would also add to it, as I've been known to do, that it requires a big investment in systems research to do well. And a few comments in terms of closing recommendations. Number one is the fact that nutrient management is one key to improving soil quality. It has to be part of the system. And mitigating greenhouse gases, even when corn is grown after corn. And for nitrogen, this presumes that we know the optimum source, rate, timing, and placement for corn after corn in a given soil and climate situation. And I'm pleased to see some of the ongoing studies, but I would argue that they need to be more fundamental in terms of examination of soil, stover, you know, all of the nitrogen properties which allow us to do proper end budgets. Corn stover removal is not a feature that I'm in favor of, especially not when there's no manure being returned on the farms. And I would argue that we should not be removing the corn stover until we know what tillage system is going to preserve the soil organic matter the best. Some cases it might be no-till, but I don't believe that it's always going to be no-till, and how we can do so without having erosion loss. And I would argue not just erosion loss at T, but perhaps erosion loss at half of T should be our target because of the equipment capability that we now have in the Corn Belt to seed these hybrids at and to place the seed well and to get good response in no-till and strip-till. The nutrient concentrations in the harvested fractions of corn, I think, need to be better understood. It's quite clear if you look at some of these data sets, whether it's Nebraska, whether it's Indonesia, whether it's Asia, whether it's Indiana, that there's a lot of variation. And using some of these averages, I think, especially in high-yield environments, we may find that we're considerably off the mark. And even if no-till and strip-till systems become more acceptable with stover removal, and perhaps that could be regarded as a bit of a plus if this Illinois research continues to show the same kind of responses in success, in future years, we've still got problems with nitrous oxide emissions and nitrate leaching losses, which I believe are the biggest environmental challenge with continuous corn, even bigger, I think, than the tillage. So I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you very much for your attention.